Shrink Wrap Radio number 584, Trauma Sensitive Mindfulness with Dr. David Trelevan.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. David Trelevan, psychotherapist and author, and we'll be discussing his 2017 book, Trauma-Sensitive Mindfulness, Practices for Safe and Transformative Healing. For more information about David Trelevan, Ph.D., please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. David Trelevan, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, David. Really good to be with you.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here. I received a notice from Norton Books, congratulations, by the way, about your 2017 book, Trauma-Sensitive Mindfulness, Practices for Safe and Transformative Healing. And I was immediately intrigued. It seems to me everyone has jumped onto the mindfulness bandwagon to the extent that I've somewhat jokingly suggested that we might be in the midst of a mindfulness bubble. In fact, I think it was in a recent issue of the American Psychologist that I read a critical review of research on mindfulness decrying a lack of consistency in the way that researchers define and measure mindfulness. Now, you've been studying the benefits of meditation for around 20 years, and in the last 10, you've been looking at the potentially adverse effects. I'm wondering if you agree that the research on mindfulness suffers from a lack of standardized definitions and measures.
It's a great entryway into the conversation. I do. I agree. I really think that it's a moment, a key moment inside of the history of mindfulness here in the West to say, okay, so we have, what is it now? 3 decades, 35 years of pretty grounded empirical research that has been focused a lot on where mindfulness meditation and programs support mindfulness with stress. And I do think it's a moment to really turn and face that research and say, where is it grounded? Where could we do better? And then what I'm trying to offer with my book is to get increasingly nuanced around how we're disseminating mindfulness practice and mindfulness-based interventions. Mm-hmm. Specifically, David, I want to challenge the idea that mindfulness is something of a panacea.
Right. Yeah,
I really want to push on that.
Yeah, that was one of the words that came to mind this morning as I was in the shower. I thought of the old saw that I'm sure you've heard of, give a small boy a hammer and everything looks like a nail. And so it's like, it is seeming more and more like being offered as a panacea, that no matter what you've got that's troubling you, mindfulness is going to fix you up. And I know that you're, we could give a misleading impression here that somehow you're down on mindfulness. You're not. You're very much I don't know if believer is the right word. I'm searching for the right word.
Yeah, I'm searching for it too. Maybe the word proponent.
Yeah.
A proponent of mindfulness meditation and the interventions. And I think I'll just say it up front for your listeners that really the punchline of the whole book is to say that mindfulness meditation can help for folks that have experienced trauma, can support them, and at the same time and in the same breath, it can actually hinder folks and it can exacerbate trauma symptoms. So we have this double-edged sword with mindfulness meditation, and I want to be in the conversation with people to say, okay, well, what would people who are studying or practicing mindfulness, especially teaching it, need to know in order practice in what I'm calling, what is called typically a trauma-sensitive way.
Yeah, and not only teachers, but also therapists who increasingly integrate some kind of version of mindfulness into their work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And some of the stories that come out in the book is, and stories that I've heard over the years, is people wrote and they said, I I started to practice mindfulness. I received some instruction online, and then I started using it with clients. And people take a practice that's working for them and start applying it in a clinical way. And the emails that I get, sometimes it helps, and it can, and other times it can go a little bit off the rails. We're having people focus more sustained attention on their moment-to-moment experience can actually exacerbate certain symptoms. And so that's what I'm interested in the conversation with clinicians, is to say, how can we use this most effectively as a tool practice? Because it's a powerful one.
Yeah. You know, you said double-edged sword, and immediately I thought of a scalpel, which is a very useful tool if you need surgery or somebody's conducting surgery, but also could be extremely destructive.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah.
So let's back way up. How did you get into this whole area in the first place?
Well, I'll give you the shorter version.
Oh, we've got time.
For your listeners, I'll give them the shorter version. So I'm originally from Canada and trained as a psychotherapist at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And where I ended up specializing my focus was working with male sex offenders. So for a number of years, I was doing forensic work with men who had committed sex crimes, and also a lot of the men were survivors themselves. So I was in,
of course, yeah.
Yeah, I was in some, which is a whole other conversation.
Sure. And
I was in some pretty deep water and a little bit over my head.
Yeah.
Mission, and was pretty stressed out. And mindfulness, this was in the early 2000s, mindfulness was really starting to take off inside of psychology as a powerful stress reduction intervention. And I had a couple friends that were into it. They said, you should come to this retreat. And so I got really hooked. I got really hooked, and I found mindfulness meditation so powerful and helpful. Fast forward about 8 years later, I was on an intensive meditation retreat, and I ended up having the experience. I had quite a powerful and difficult experience on the retreat, where it felt like almost like a circuit breaker going off in my body. And for a couple days, I couldn't really feel my feet. Everything felt quite neutral, and all my senses got a little bit muffled. And I went to the teachers and I said, I don't know what's happening. I'm a little scared. What should I do? And the teachers, who were very well-intentioned, said, just keep coming back to your experience. And I tried that for a couple more days and found that it was actually exacerbating things. I wasn't feeling much better. And the long story short is that I was here in California and ended up getting to do a doctoral degree and focused my attention on what's the intersection of mindfulness and trauma. I had a couple people say, you know, based on the work you were doing, it was possible you might have been experiencing secondary trauma. And they kind of kept guiding me towards the study of the intersection of trauma and mindfulness.
So in other words, I just want to back up on the secondary trauma. All this work that you were doing with offenders and probably hearing just horrible stories about the traumas that they had suffered before going out and committing traumas on other people, that somehow that got internalized and was traumatizing to you.
Yeah, I appreciate you pausing me there. So that was a lot of what I was working with inside of practice, was a lot about the stories that I had been exposed to and was really just deep inside of with these different folks I was working with. Mm-hmm. And on this retreat, that was what was happening, is there was a particular scene that I had heard in my own practice that kept coming to mind, and was experiencing some flashbacks around it and intrusive thoughts, and really kept trying to work with this by applying mindful attention.
Yeah. So is there a literature for vicarious trauma? Because there's so much interest in trauma. I'm not disputing your experience, but is there a literature around that?
Well, as I understand it, there's a lot of literature on it. It hasn't been a primary focus for me inside of research. But as I understand the DSM definition of PTSD is to say, yes, people who are continually exposed in their own work can actually end up having symptoms of trauma, which opens up this huge conversation for all of us. Mm-hmm. What do we mean by trauma, and how do we get exposed to it? And I'll say one person I've learned a lot from is a woman named Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, who's up in Seattle. You might have heard of her, but she did a powerful book called Trauma Stewardship on this. But the empirical research, I think it's continuing and it's ongoing.
Okay, good, good. So what motivated you to write this particular book at this particular time?
Yeah, well, what happened was, inside of, so this topic came up, I started to study it and realized quite soon there wasn't any empirical research at the time. People had said, okay, well, we're at the point with mindfulness meditation and mindfulness intervention research to say, we think that it's positive, we don't know. And I realized, oh, people hadn't done much work around the intersection of mindfulness and traumatic stress. So did a theoretical dissertation on the topic. And then actually started speaking more about my own experiences. And this is where the story got interesting for me, is that my dissertation defense ended up online. And
yes,
people,
I saw it there.
It's oh, cool. I mean,
it's on YouTube.
It's a very grainy video. It was unexpected that people would be watching it.
Yeah, it's a terrible video. The the audio's not that good. But it's there, and I wanted to get some sense of you, and fortunately enough came through to say, yeah, I'd like to talk to this guy.
Well, that's great. I'm glad. So that's what happened, is that a couple people ended up seeing it, watching it, and then I started to get a lot of emails, and I started to get a lot of correspondence from people saying, hey, this is an experience similar to what I had. Can I tell you my story?
Mm.
So what I realized is, oh, if the research on the prevalence of trauma is true, and given that mindfulness meditation is just continuing to explode in popularity, this would suggest to me that in any room where mindfulness is being practiced, there's a good chance that there might be one person who's experiencing traumatic stress or traumatic symptoms. And so that's part of where the book came from, was to say, what would mindfulness, people who are using mindfulness in their therapeutic practice or teaching it, what would they want to know? What are some practical modifications for basic instruction to ensure that it's being practiced in a trauma-sensitive way?
Yeah, and you know what? When you say presenting something to a group of people, I think we're beginning to understand that people get triggered, and that as a group leader, you never know what you might say that you would think would just be totally neutral and a reasonable thing to say, and then somebody comes up maybe at the end and says something, or somebody off in the corner starts crying or gets up and leaves the class or the group. That seems to be a whole almost new phenomenon, or at least a sensitivity to that phenomenon.
Right, exactly. I think that's exactly one of the edges that we're on inside of, at least I'll say, the mindfulness community movement, would be to say, how could we know? I mean, given that it's such an internal practice, how would one know that someone is experiencing a severe dissociation or flashbacks unless they were talking to you? And so I think you're right. I think it's to say, what's the responsibility for those of us who are in positions of power? What should we be looking for? Mm-hmm. And what would it be like if we went into our work assuming that the powerful practices and interventions we're offering people may actually create some dysregulation? And how can we set the scaffolding to really prepare ourselves to be making sure that folks aren't falling through the cracks? So I totally agree with you on that point. I think that's where we're looking.
Yeah, because I'm sort of broadening it beyond mindfulness and just a variety of topics that, you know, having been a professor and the environment of empowerment that we're in right now, where students may feel empowered sufficiently to complain either to the professor or to the administration or something, that that this person has been insensitive to my problems and it's causing me distress. That's a complex issue, I think.
Very complex. And it's one of the pieces in the book, if you're interested to engage here with this, is this book is coming out to me in a very particular moment, historical moment. And to have this whole past year, number of years, of course, well, decades of organizing, but, you know, this real increasing awareness around oppression. And we have organizations and groups like Black Lives Matter as a movement. We have the Me Too campaign. I think there's a real live and challenging and exciting conversation about what do we mean by trauma and who's being impacted by trauma. And like you're saying, people are starting to actually speak up in classes. And it's creating a lot of different dynamics, a power dynamics inside of classes. So I've also wanted to be in the conversation to say, how are we talking about trauma? And I'll just come out and say, I've been taught to think about trauma not just as an individual tragedy, but something that's actually, especially interpersonal trauma, is deeply rooted inside of systems of oppression and power. And that we as teachers, especially, I'll say for me as a white man, to be at the front of the room, if I'm not really trying to tune in to how people might have experienced trauma, both in their lives, historically, it's a big miss. And it's not as trustworthy to me, that practice. So that's also a huge part of what I want to talk about, is around how are we framing trauma? How are we looking?
Yeah, yeah. In your quest to understand your own trauma and work with it, you began to explore traumatology, if you will. You began to look into other approaches to, or how trauma is being dealt with today. And one of the approaches that I gather that was quite effective for you was Peter Levine's somatic experiencing. So share with us what you can about that.
I'd love to. Yeah, so that was part of the inspiration. Well, by the way, I assume that a lot of your listeners would be both informed about trauma, probably practicing inside of trauma modalities. Is that right?
Well, some. I don't know how many. There's quite a range of people who listen. They all seem to be very interested in psychology broadly, and they range all the way from people who just have an intellectual interest to students at various levels, to I hear from many clinicians, therapists, and some professors. So quite a range, but you don't have to feel like you need to scale it down. Everybody seems to be comfortable with the levels of sophistication.
So, that's great. Yeah. Well, I ask because what happened to me in starting to study trauma as a trauma professional and really starting to get training with people like Peter Levine and somatic experiencing, and also learning a lot from Pat Ogden and sensory motor psychotherapy, what I learned is that there are some amazing teachers who have done such depthful work, Bessel van der Kolk, just fantastic work around trauma.
Yeah.
And so part of the inspiration too was to say, oh my gosh, there is this incredible wealth of knowledge that is applicable for so many people working inside of mental health, and particularly inside of the mindfulness community. What would be useful for folks that are teaching or clinicians to know about trauma theory and trauma therapy to bring in and really bring them into conversation?
Yeah.
So that was my inspiration, and I'm happy to talk a little bit about somatic experiencing, but that's the foundation, is to put them in conversation and see what they have to say.
Yeah, I think sometime back I've had one or two guests who've spoken about trauma since somatic experiencing, but I could use a refresher, and I'm sure my audience could too.
Yeah. Wow.
And I haven't been able to interview Peter Levine. I reached out, but I couldn't get through to him.
It's hard to get a hold of.
Yeah.
I'd say the punchline of somatic experiencing is that more is not more. More is not always more. And this is why I was so drawn to Peter Levine's work in somatic experiencing, is he was really saying, if you as a clinician just encourage someone to go directly at symptoms of trauma, that actually isn't going to support the unwinding and the integration of the overwhelming event. That if you just try to do it all at once, you know, here I am in California, we have a lot of modalities where we're just kind of whipping up a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And Peter, you know, it's a very nuanced work, and you might've heard the word titration. And so you go and you do a little bit of work around traumatic symptoms that could be memories or sensations. And then you come back and you resource a little bit and you find places in the body that feel safe and grounded and resourceful. So the work really looks like this, and it's a powerful model. But the applicability to mindfulness meditation is that when you plunk someone on a cushion and say, pay attention to your experience, people will naturally, based on neurological mechanisms, spend the energy because of an orienting response that is deeply wired in us. We're going to pay attention to what is feeling alarming or not working.
Yeah.
And then if you follow basic instructions, people can get stuck. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not saying mindfulness meditation can help survivors, and it often does for trauma survivors on a retreat, but there will be some people that I'm learning can fall through the cracks. And so that was where, with Peter Levine's work, he was saying, don't have folks immediately pay attention to what is triggering. Sometimes we need to start with what's more resourceful. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's a very powerful frame inside of mindfulness meditation. So that was a big takeaway for me inside.
When you say more resourceful, you mean what?
I would mean safety. The words I use would be safety and stability. So, you know, anyone listening right now, you could think of, for your clients, the people you work with, where are the, what are the moments and where are the places where they feel calmer, safer, more grounded, more resourced, and able to tolerate stress in a more effective way. In somatic experiencing, we'll do this actually physically. You'll look for places in the body that don't feel like they're a four-alarm fire. It could be a fingertip, just like, okay, I feel okay there. We, you know, we start with that. So for trauma, that's often a really big move. And, you know, David, I just want to say one more thing too, is the book does not, I'm not making the argument that mindfulness teachers should become trauma therapists. If they want to, that's great. But more specifically, I want them to know how to refer. I want people to know, and maybe this is something you can speak to, I want people to be able to assess when it's a moment to refer, and that they might be in their head, because we don't want to say, oh, this is great. Trauma's coming up. Mindfulness will help reveal and heal it. I think that's a little bit overreaching. What do you think of that? Do you think that it seems like it's been a part of your work, is helping people assess their own competence inside of practice? Is that right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Would it be helpful for me to define what I mean by trauma-informed practice?
Yeah.
Would that be useful? It's a quick one. I just want your listeners to get this. Like, hey, well, what does that mean, trauma-sensitive practice? And there's a 4R definition that comes from the National Center for Trauma-Informed Care. It's really quick. It's, if someone is going to call themselves trauma-informed around mindfulness, they've realized the widespread impact of trauma, they can recognize traumatic symptoms, they can respond skillfully, and prevent re-traumatization. That's really, that encapsulates the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a big path. It's a big thing to take on for any of us.
So, can you say a little bit more about what the issue is with people who've suffered trauma and go on to practice mindfulness meditation? What are those negative sequelae, if you will?
No, that's great. Well, I'll back it up for a moment just to ground this in research. I want to just, for listeners that are in academia, or there. But the first thing to say is that there isn't a lot of empirical research to say, well, what is happening for people that have experienced, that are experiencing traumatic stress or traumatic symptoms that come into a mindfulness-based intervention? There really isn't a lot of grounded research. So I want to start by saying that. And there's an important study that just came out in the journal, is it Plus One? It's an article on what's called the Varieties of Contemplative Experience Project. And this came out of Brown University, and this is two researchers that have been working for the last 7-8 years to do an in-depth qualitative study around what's happening for people that are running into challenging experiences of meditation.
Yeah.
And the head researcher, Willoughby Britton, presented this to the Dalai Lama at Mind and Life, and really just entered this conversation to say, what about challenging experiences? What can we say? Inside of this research, there were a number of cases of folks who are expressing traumatic symptoms, and that there looks like there is an intersection between trauma, mindfulness, meditation. So I'm just interested in the conversation and being at the table here. I want to overreach. Yeah. And the one thing I will say is, if you can just imagine, for someone who's experiencing symptoms of traumatic stress, they often feel out of control. They, at any moment, they can experience sensations, kind of gut-wrenching sensations that just overwhelm them. They can have flashbacks. They can have intrusive thoughts. It's this feeling of like, I'm in the car, but I'm not driving. That's how someone named it to me once. And imagine going on a meditation retreat and being told to just be with your experience in a sustained and consistent way. And for some people, that can be helpful. And for other people, that ends up really turning the heat up. It can really, I heard from a person who I ended up working with who said, I went on the retreat and it just felt like I turned the knob from 2 to 8. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I wasn't in control. I was paying attention, but it felt like it was exacerbating the flashbacks that I was having, and I didn't have the strategies to work with it. I was really alone. And the one other thing I'll say, David, is that if you can imagine, especially a seated retreat, this client of mine said, you know, I opened my eyes and I looked around and no one was there. All I saw was the backs of people's heads. And that was dysregulating for them. They didn't have a chance. Yeah. You know, so I think it can be a setup for some people. And I'm not saying mindfulness meditation is bad at all, right, but that there are certain things we could have in place to make the experience more safe and regulating for someone who's experienced trauma.
Well, it occurs to me that a retreat is a particularly intense experience and really is deliberately a consciousness, an altered state of consciousness inducing experience, and altered states of consciousness can be tricky.
Agreed.
Very elevating in some situations for some people, very scary for other people in other situations.
Agreed. Yeah. And
I never thought about it that way, but until now.
We're in deep water when we're on a retreat, and I just want to acknowledge there's such deep lineages here inside of mindfulness and meditation of people that have been thinking about these questions a long time. So sure. Spirit Rock here in May, they actually encourage their teachers to go through the somatic experiencing program. So people have been thinking about this, and I want to speak to a broader community of folks who are interested in getting better and better at this.
Do you know what the Dalai Lama answered when that question was put to him?
Yeah, well, actually, it's interesting. Folks can go online, and if you type in Willoughby Britton, Dalai Lama, the talk is actually there. It was recorded. Uh-huh. So I don't want to, it's been a year or two since I've seen his response, so I want to do it justice. But there was both agreement and this amazing intersection, as you can imagine, of hundreds, thousands of years of deep Tibetan Buddhist tradition and what those frameworks would say about challenging experiences inside of meditation practice. And then here we have this much more contemporary tradition of which Willoughby and others were coming from and saying, how do we think about mindfulness? Is it connected to a larger framework within Buddhist practice? Is it a specific intervention that we can study? So it's an hour-long, 45-minute conversation, which I don't want to just try to encapsulate, but I encourage your listeners to go there because it's fascinating. He gets the translation and he gives a really strong response. So.
Yeah, great. I've run across that name, Willoughby Britton, but it's one I've seen. I've not interviewed her or reached out to her. Sounds like that might be a good direction for me to pursue.
Yeah, she's great. She's doing really grounded, powerful research at Brown University. She has her own lab there. And I encourage listeners, if they're interested, to check out this Varieties of Contemplative Experience project. And also they have what's called a Meditation Safety Toolkit. And that is a whole bunch of great resources for people who are interested in saying, well, what would it mean to think of meditation as something that's potentially challenging, and how would we offer it to people in different ways?
Mm-hmm. Now, you distinguish between mindfulness and mindfulness meditation. So tell us about what that distinction is and why that distinction is important.
Yeah, I'd be interested in your opinion on this too. I don't, what feels so key, and you started the interview with this, I don't want to be seen as someone who's throwing mindfulness under the bus. Mm-hmm. And I think in many ways, and I fall victim to this, you know, mindfulness and meditation can be collapsed. They can often be talked about as one and the same. But what I'd like to say here is that mindfulness itself as a quality of mind, as a quality of attention, is often incredibly helpful for people that have experienced traumatic stress or for any clients. Like the ability to have a quality of dual awareness, to be able to know what's happening when it's happening, is so powerful and useful for clients. And at the same, and what I often have discovered when talking to people is that mindfulness will reveal trauma. Mindfulness will, it's like a strong light that shows us places that need healing and places that need our attention.
Sure.
And it's the practice of mindfulness, mindfulness meditation, Vipassana meditation. I'm focusing on Vipassana in particular because it's so popular right now. That is often where people are running into trouble. Mindfulness itself is not the problem. It's the way we pursue that, pursue mindfulness, that ends up running in people into trouble. And it's often, and listeners won't be surprised by this, it's often people who really go to extremes with the practice that can run into problems. Now, it's rare that someone will just try mindfulness meditation for 5 minutes and run into a big traumatic memory, though that can happen. It's often more in longer-term sessions and practices where people will get themselves into hot water. So that's why I want to differentiate between the two.
Okay. And you emphasize that while trauma-sensitive mindfulness meditation can be beneficial, it should not be considered a substitute for trauma therapy.
Yeah.
And why is that?
Well, I mean, I'm curious what you think about this, given your time in the field. I really, really want to just challenge folks in a loving way who would orient to trauma as just an intensely negative emotion. And I think that's how I oriented to it. First, I thought, oh, trauma, just that's just a big, hard feeling. Where in actuality, when you start digging into the literature around trauma, especially this last book from Bessel van der Kolk, that a lot of your listeners will probably know, The Body Keeps the Score, we find that traumatic stress is such a complex tangle. We have biological, psychological, social dimensions of trauma that we need to be well-versed in to help people. So I want to challenge people to not just think, oh, well, I'm just going to encourage someone who's having flashbacks to just keep paying attention to that or just keep feeling. And this is the more is not always more piece, mm-hmm. is that I want us to keep being, I would want practitioners to keep being sensitive about how dysregulating trauma can be, and really to set themselves on a path of saying, okay, what do I need to do if I'm going to be working with trauma directly? How can I train myself to be skillful enough? I'm curious what you think, practitioners over the years too there.
I'm not sure I can speak to that.
Fair enough.
You describe trauma as ubiquitous, and so I want to ask, is that too broad? And you're kind of not the recently I've been hearing that sort of thing from more people. I think trauma used to be sort of a very circumspect event kind of thing. And now I've had guests that say, well, we're all traumatized, that life is traumatizing. So tell us, you know, what sorts of trauma are we talking about here?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think this is a needle to thread. And I think we run into the danger here of if we start saying that everything is traumatic, that we're watering down important science and research and folks that have done really grounded empirical research about what's happening when we have this cluster of symptoms. Now, I don't know what you think of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. I know there's lots of controversy for some folks around it, but you know, there is a lot of research going into these four particular symptom areas inside of the PTSD diagnosis. The definition of trauma that I'm using is any threatening, overwhelming experience that we can't integrate, that is mm-hmm. too much for our nervous system, and it leaves us feeling helpless, frightened, overwhelmed, and profoundly unsafe. That's a definition I want to use. Now, we'll all have that to some degree, and research tells us, the study that I cite in there says, 90 to 92% of us internationally will be exposed to a traumatic event. But as you and your listeners will know, that doesn't mean that we'll necessarily have traumatic symptoms ongoing. And there's debate about this, about how many of us will develop post-traumatic stress. The numbers I use are between 15 and 18% will potentially develop post-traumatic stress. So I think it's a great and important question of, well, what are we saying when we mean trauma? And I want to, inside of this, so some of the examples could be a car accident, and experiencing interpersonal violence. I had sudden loss of a child. You know, things that leave us, it's just deeply overwhelming for us. And at the same time, this is where I want to help broaden the conversation, and people have been doing research here, including with someone, Monica Williams at the University of Connecticut, to say, the everyday impacts of oppression for people who are targeted by systems of oppression actually over time can also lead to traumatic responses and actually be overwhelming. I'm really interested in that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What does overwhelm us? And David, other thing I'll say is, at the end of the day, what's important is less, I think, the labels we put on it and the acknowledgement that some people's nervous systems become profoundly dysregulated. That's actually what we're working with, whether we call it trauma for insurance forms or not. That's a very important debate, and I'm most interested in when someone becomes profoundly dysregulated and how do we work with that effectively, especially inside of mindfulness.
Yeah. You know, as I'm listening to you, I'm also kind of scanning my own experience, you know, have I been traumatized, you know, kind of wondering. And you mentioned automobile accidents, and I've been in a couple of automobile accidents as a younger person, and a motorcycle accident that would be pretty traumatic. Mm-hmm. I don't think they led to PTSD in my case. I also was with a friend once in a bar where a fight broke out. And this one guy just beat this other guy just mercilessly, went by pretty fast. And my friend that I was with, he wasn't nearly as aware of it as I was. It was no big deal to him. I felt pretty traumatized just being present in that situation. Mm-hmm. And it comes up, I remember it, you know, like to talk about it now. So, So yeah, I think that was traumatic for me, even though I don't think it's not particularly led to PTSD, but it does tap into a fear about physical safety and violence and threat from the outside.
Yeah, that's real. It's I think it's an important place to dig in, is to say, well, mm-hmm. what are the areas of our life where something happened that was too much, mm-hmm. too much for our psychobiology, or too much for us to process in the moment? And what's the work that we would need to do with others? And again, this gets into mental health professionals, is how do we support each other to integrate those experiences?
Yeah.
Can I tell you a quick story here? A teacher of mine tells a story about the culture that we're in around overwhelming experience and trauma that I think is helpful around this. And for us to know as mental health practitioners and folks working in this field, they were crossing a street on Fell Street in San Francisco, and there's those timed lights on Fell Street. And there was a car, and a car blew through a red light, and she's watching this family. It was a caregiver and three kids that had entered the intersection. And this car blew through a red light, and the caregiver had to really yank the whole family and dive back onto the sidewalk, you know, really scary thing for the kids. And there was a five-year-old that was there who really started to cry and shake. And this teacher of mine was watching this and said that what happened in this moment was that the caregiver went to the kid and said, you need to stop it. Stop right now. Because I think the caregiver was also scared themselves, you know. And what the kid did, this teacher was watching, was really clamped his jaw down and stopped crying, you know, and said, okay, for me to stay in connection with my caregiver here, I have to really clamp down right now and not let this run through. Now, this isn't to shame the caregiver at all, but to say that we'll often be in a culture where when we're feeling overwhelmed, we'll try to tamp down. And this could have been different if the caregiver had said, that's okay, why don't you just, you can sit down and just let that shaking happen. You know, these scary events that we had the chance to integrate and process. Oh, do you want to tell me about how that was? It was scary, right? So that's the domain we're in as humans, as in these animal bodies of things that happen where we have a fight-flight response and it can't always move through the system. And then the problems that that can create later. So I think that's
I seem to recall that shaking one of the therapeutic interventions in somatic experiencing? Well, I don't know where I'm getting that from.
Yeah. It wouldn't be necessarily, as I understand it, not a direct intervention that we want to encourage, we want to tell someone to start shaking, but that if that happened inside of a session, that would be encouraged and welcomed. Like, actually, that's good news, that the charge in the system could actually be moving. For those who are interested, if you read Peter Levine's first book, Waking the Tiger, he tells an amazing story about the title of the book, why it's called Waking the Tiger, of a client whose legs started to shake. And he just said, run from, and the person's legs really got moving. And he said, and that's really informed him inside the methodology, is how do we let the body unwind and discharge trauma?
Yeah. Another parallel that comes to mind is in bioenergetics, they have what are called stress postures. You know, this is based on Wilhelm Reich's work.
Right.
And actually to put your body in positions where shaking starts to happen naturally. And I guess the idea there is, you said something about discharging energy, and I guess that's kind of the point of that.
I actually met a military veteran who had PTSD and was actively doing that practice and found it very helpful. Mm-hmm. It was for him a real discharge. He explained it like a shaken up bottle of soda, and it was like releasing some of the soda for him, some of the air.
Yeah.
So I heard that can be very powerful.
Yeah. So what do we know about the brain and the body? That's something you touch on in your book. Share whatever you want to here about the brain and its role in all of this.
Right. Well, I'll say up front that I'm not a neuroscientist.
And nor am I.
And I'm around a couple. And in that chapter in the book, I was most interested to say, okay, given what's out there now and the research, what are the intersections, what are the important intersections between the two? And I'd say the main punchline here is what in this recent book, Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk, what he talks about of the differentiation between the rational and the emotional brains. So our most, what the neocortex, which he calls the rational brain, the newest part of our brain where we do a lot of meaning making and regulation from there. And then underneath that, what he calls the emotional brain or the limbic system. Now with trauma, what's happening is the limbic system, especially the amygdala, is firing a response. It's kind of like a smoke detector going off. And what happens in post-traumatic stress is that we're not able to regulate that response. Our neocortex would say, no, we look around in the present moment. The alarm bells are going off. We look around and go, no, we're safe. We can assess that we're safe. But when trauma happens, the amygdala and other things that are happening in the limbic system are creating this whole five-alarm fire, and we can't actually calm down. We're out of control. So what the mindfulness research says is that actually consistent mindfulness meditation can increase our ability to self-regulate, and it can actually decrease the structural size of the amygdala in the brain. Mm. So theoretically, at least, mindfulness meditation can be helpful for trauma survivors in that you're increasing the ability to regulate your attention, regulate your emotions, pay attention to your body, which really lights up certain parts of the neocortex, what he calls the watchtower, which is really just above the eye in our brain. And it allows us to regulate the amygdala when it's firing. So that's purely theoretical and speculative right now. But that's really the key takeaway, is that the body is producing all this stress and traumatic stress and symptoms, and that mindfulness meditation can actually be useful and helpful for being able to watch over and say, oh, I know what's happening in this present moment and I can self-regulate.
Yeah. This whole vocabulary of regulation and dysregulation is very interesting. It's relatively new. It's come out of all this brain research, I think, neurological research, and thinking of it from a clinical point of view, there's a way in which it kind of brings it all down to earth in a common sense kind of way, and is in no way blaming.
Yes, right.
It doesn't make the person bad or wrong or morally deficient because of whatever issues they're dealing with.
That's so true.
Yeah.
I had a client who had a significant loss, and in the 3 months following this loss was going to work and experiencing sometimes hypervigilance, increased tracking, shortness of breath, and then other times just felt depressed, exhausted, and really dissociated. And it was so helpful to be able to say to this person in the frame of regulation, oh, you're really dysregulated. And you're either up, you're either too high or too low. You can't find that middle ground. And there's a chapter in my book about this model called the window of tolerance that some people might have heard of. It's a term originally coined by Dan Siegel, amazing teacher and neuroscientist, to say we have this window that we're functioning in mm-hmm. every day. And that with trauma, we're in hyper or hypo arousal. We're underneath the window. And so I think what you said, it's really normalizing.
Yeah.
For people just to hear, it's not your fault.
Right, right.
And we can give you some practices to help you regulate.
Yeah. And we're all familiar, just about everybody is familiar with the idea of homeostasis, which is a long time way of talking about that in relation to body temperature and things like that. But this is sort of broadening it, this window of, what did you call it, the window of?
The window of tolerance.
Of tolerance, yeah. And homeostasis works that way, right? There's a range within which we're okay. As long as we can come back into that range, we're okay. And also with weight and weight control and the whole thing about how difficult it is to lose weight because we've got a zone that our body's going to keep us in pretty much willy-nilly.
That's right. And the window, I don't know about you, with the weather, we're not too far away. When it got really gray and cloudy here, it dipped off for a week and I thought, God, I'm really down. Mm-hmm. And one thing I appreciate about the window is that it reminds us, right, as humans, our day-to-day life isn't necessarily one of homeostasis where we're just trying to stay flat. We'll have highs and lows. And the people who've experienced trauma experience extreme highs and lows, or they mm-hmm. can. Mm-hmm. And that often, it really gets in the way of one's quality of life. So, yeah, I found that frame around the window of tolerance extremely useful and have a whole chapter on in the book. So.
Yeah. In your book, you've also outlined 5 principles of trauma-sensitive mindfulness. Maybe you can take us through those.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So, the window of tolerance is one, and working skillfully with it. It's a very helpful frame. So the principle itself is, how can we, as practitioners, mental health workers, how can we help people stay within this window of tolerance? The second is called shift attention to support stability. So how, when we're working with mindfulness and mindfulness-based interventions, how can we actually help people work with their attention in a way that promotes stability instead of actually dysregulation, as we were just talking about? The third one is keep the body in mind. And this is a whole, in all of these chapters, by the way, at the end of a chapter, I have, 5 to 10 different modifications to say, here's some suggestions, here's the theory, and here's the practice.
Okay.
Working with these principles. Keep the body in mind. This is like, how do we work with the body? How can we skillfully do that? Do we take breaks? Do we stretch? Do we not? How can we as folks working in mindfulness do that? Fourth is practice in relationship. Often mindfulness meditation can be a solitary experience, and trauma theory tells us that we can leverage interpersonal relationship in a really powerful way. Even you and I just watching each other, facial expressions, there's so much potentially resourcing material there we can work with. And the last one is understand social context. And what I mean by that is that we and anyone in a position of power working therapeutically, working with mindfulness, needs to be very attuned and sensitive to the power dynamics that are happening in a space. I've heard lots of stories of people who came to me and said, you know, I went on a retreat. This is someone, person of color who went to a retreat and said, it was predominantly white folks. And the teacher said something just kind of really culturally insensitive to me. And it brought up this historical trauma or this trauma that I had. And they didn't know how to hold it. I didn't want to work with it. And so I left the retreat. Hmm. So I think there's a responsibility for all of us. And this is an ongoing path for all of us, myself included. How do we do that well? So those are the five principles that I'm working with. And I'm open. If readers have any more, they can write me. Tell me
about that. Great. You seem like a relatively young guy. And what is your career currently? Are you a therapist? Are you doing therapist? Are you a teacher? Are you an author? I know you're an author. What do you see the shape of your career here?
Well, thanks for asking. And thanks for saying I look young. I'll take it. I'm feeling older. Well, I just turned 40. And where I have been working, I was working as a trauma professional. I was working as a psychotherapist in Canada. I was working as a trauma professional. Now it's been 15 years now. And I'm in a pretty big pivot in this moment as this book is coming out to say, I really enjoy teaching. I really enjoy teaching. So I'm not seeing folks individually at the moment. I started to shift off that practice. But teaching, I'm going to be at a number of different centers this year, offering trainings to people that are teaching or practicing mindfulness. We're going to be at the Center for Mindfulness at the University of Massachusetts in a couple months. Original Jon Kabat-Zinn's original center. And so I'll be at a mega this summer, but basically trying to get the word out and being in conversation with folks about, well, what would a trauma-sensitive practice look like? And the one thing I'll say is that I'm, because of my interest in social justice, I'm donating 60% of the book to three different social justice organizations that I think are doing on the ground work, challenging the conditions, the social conditions, which are perpetuating trauma, especially interpersonal trauma. So I'm really interested in the conversation about what do we mean? What are we doing? What are we up to right now?
Well, I think you're going to be a very important contributor to that conversation as time goes on. And it seems like you're moving in the direction of a workshop leader, and I suspect you'll be doing more writing as well. So let me know when we need to talk about your next book.
I will. I'll be lucky if I get there.
Yeah. Is there anything as we wind down that you didn't get to touch on here that you would like to?
No, not for now. I really appreciate the conversation, and both with you and listeners. To me, I really hold this as a conversation. I would encourage folks. Please reach out. Let me know what I missed or what you'd add and where it worked for you. I want this to be really useful to folks.
How can people get in touch with you then if you want to invite that?
If you go on my website, this is davidtrelevin.com. And there's a form. You can email me directly. It'll come directly to me. I read every email, and I'm happy to be in touch. So just encourage folks to reach out, and that's the best way to get a hold of me.
Okay. Dr. David Trelevin, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. I think Dr. Trelevin has put his finger on an important need and is doing good work. As we both noted at the beginning of the interview, in some ways, mindfulness is being oversold as a panacea. This is not to diminish the value of mindfulness meditation, but a more nuanced approach is needed when it comes to using it therapeutically. Dr. Trelevin is making an important contribution in that direction. Dr. Trelevin mentioned several important people in the field whom I've interviewed. If you haven't already listened to them, I think you might appreciate episode number 436, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma, with Bessel van der Kolk MD, and or number 399, Trauma and the Body, with Pat Ogden, PhD. I highly recommend David Trelavin's book, Trauma-Sensitive Mindfulness Practices for Safe and Transformative Healing. If you decide to purchase it, I hope you will use the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar to do that. Just click on one of the two book ads from Amazon near the top of that right-hand sidebar, and then you'll be able to search for Dr. Trelavin's book.
This is Ted Leckie. I'm an EFT couples therapist practicing in Toronto. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for years and love the breadth of modalities and therapeutic ideas I have been exposed to by listening. I can't count the number of books I have ended up buying after listening to your interviews, following up on wonderful new directions. Thanks so much, Dr. Dave. Your podcast is much appreciated.
Thank you, Ted Leckie, our newest donor, for your financial commitment to Shrink Wrap Radio, letting other listeners know why you've made that choice. I really appreciate it. Next week, my guest will be Australian psychologist Richard Hill, and we'll be discussing his 2018 book with co-author Ernie Rossi, which is titled The Practitioner's Guide to Mirroring Hands, a client-responsive therapy that facilitates natural problem-solving and mind-body healing. I'm expecting a fascinating interview about this new development on the therapeutic scene, so I hope you'll join us. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the bod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
You've been shrink wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.